The CBS News Weekend Roundup, coming up next.
It's finally fall. The weather is cooling off, and there's no better time to upgrade your cookouts than right now. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks. They have a huge menu of steaks and more. The process is convenient and quick, shopping delivered straight to your door. Every purchase is backed by Omaha Steaks' 100% unconditional guarantee. And right now, you can get the limited-time family grill pack for just $49.99. You get all of this. 2 5-ounce filet mignons, 2 5-ounce top sirloins, 4 4-ounce boneless pork chops, 4 3.5-ounce chicken fried steaks, 12-ounce package of all-beef meatballs, 4 4-ounce Omaha Steak Burgers, 4 4-ounce Gourmet Jumbo Franks, a 16-ounce package of Omaha Steakhouse Fries, 4 caramel apple tartlets, OS seasoning packet, plus 4 additional Omaha Steaks Burgers. Just for listening, Omaha Steaks is offering all of this for only $49.99. This is a huge savings. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter code FTN in the search bar, and add the Family Grill Pack to your cart. Don't miss this deal. Visit omahasteaks.com and enter code FTN in the search bar to get over 30 gourmet items for just $49.99.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The long campaign for president will end with Election Day 2 weeks from this coming Tuesday. It's getting close, but most opinion poll analysts say the race is less close in recent weeks. Most pundits give Hillary Clinton a high chance of winning, Donald Trump considered likely to lose, and a big question arose, would he accept the results? We'll get into that in a moment. Later, CBS's Margaret Brennan, who was at the charity dinner in New York, where Trump and Clinton clashed, though they did shake hands.
It was supposed to be a good-natured ribbing to raise money for charity, but there were boos after the Republican nominee went on the attack.
We'll also go to Iraq, where ISIS is under attack. You'll hear CBS's Holly Williams on the charge by Trump that it was stupid to announce in advance that there'd be a big move aimed at liberating Iraq's second-largest city.
Making it public that the offensive was about to begin gave the residents of Mosul, who are being used as human shields, a chance to try to escape.
And a lot more coming up on this Weekend Roundup. I'm Dan Revive at CBS News in Washington. First, let's rewind to Wednesday evening at UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the third and final debate between the major party presidential candidates. CBS News correspondent Major Garrett said big topics were covered, but one answer dominated our attention.
There was a deep dive in the issues, abortion, immigration, the Supreme Court itself, character, taxes, entitlements, the federal debt, and the disagreements fell along ideological lines well established during this campaign. But one thing stood out, something that really debates haven't disagreed about before, whether this election would be conducted fairly and the results respected.
Are you saying you're not prepared now to commit to that principle?
What I'm saying is that I will tell you at the time. I'll keep you in suspense.
Donald Trump would not promise to accept the result of the presidential election, challenging the tradition of a peaceful transfer of power.
That's horrifying.
Reporting the big picture from the debate site, CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy.
The Republicans' refusal to say he'd accept the results of the election and honor the transfer of power that's been a hallmark of American democracy stunned many inside and outside the hall.
Do you make the same commitment that you will absolutely accept the result of this election?
I will look at it at the time. I'm not looking at anything now. I'll look at it at the time.
We've been around for 240 years. We've had free and fair elections. We've accepted the outcomes when we may not have liked them. And that is what must be expected of anyone standing on a debate stage during a general election.
This third debate featured more substance and depth than the first two, and on the whole, fewer sharp exchanges. But those that did occur were some of the harshest in this debate series. Clinton said her opponent is the favorite of the Russian president.
Putin, from everything I see, has no respect for this person.
Well, that's because he'd rather have a puppet as president of
the United States.
And it's pretty clear.
You're the puppet.
It's pretty my Social Security.
When Clinton suggested Trump might try to worm his way out of a higher Social Security tax she'd impose, Trump called her nasty.
Such a nasty woman.
Trump referenced the WikiLeaks email stolen from Clinton's campaign chairman.
John Podesta said some horrible things about you. And boy, was he right.
When discussion turned to allegations Trump has forced himself on women, he again denied it.
I didn't even apologize to my wife, who's sitting right here, because I didn't do anything.
Donald thinks belittling women makes him bigger. He goes after their dignity, their self-worth.
This whole campaign, Trump has vowed to be tough on illegal immigrants. But at this final debate, he took his rhetoric further.
We have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out.
Clinton noted Trump has hired illegal immigrants himself.
He used undocumented labor to build the Trump Tower.
And she noted he built a building here in Las Vegas with foreign material.
In a very beautiful hotel known as Trump.
Made with Chinese steel.
Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, Las Vegas.
Let's follow up with CBS News analyst Professor Leonard Steinhorn. Trump entered this final clash with Clinton trailing her in most national polls.
There were times that you could tell that Hillary Clinton was getting under his skin. There were times when it seemed like Donald Trump had swallowed a grenade and was trying his best to contain it, but occasionally it came out when he said things like, "You're a nasty woman."
Even though Trump has said recently that he doesn't really believe in the polls right now, suggesting they also might be rigged, as his supporters might put it, he has been slipping in the polls. So was there anything in the third debate that might widen his support, that might move beyond the base that he's counted on now for more than a year?
To some extent, what Donald Trump did was to double down with his base. I mean, he was very strong on guns. He was very strong on abortion. These are key Republican issues, and he spoke to the Republican conservatives who he needs to come out and vote for him in large numbers. He also talked about immigration in a way that will excite his base, and he talked about Obamacare. So he really did mention those issues that conservatives needed to hear about if they were going to go out and get enthusiastic about voting. Whether he expanded beyond that, I think he was hoping that his more measured tone would appeal to people and make him seem sort of less controversial and give him a better qualification for his character and temperament as president of the United States. He's hoping that that's what will appeal to the moderate voters who are watching and listening to this debate.
Lenny, critics of Hillary Clinton and some who say they might vote for her but they don't trust her, you know, might analyze carefully what was said in the third debate and feel that Hillary Clinton did not always answer the questions, some tough questions. One from the moderator, Chris Wallace, said, "Did you really keep your pledge to avoid even the appearance of conflicts between the Clinton Foundation and your work at the State Department?" And instead, she went on and on talking about how the Clinton Foundation does good work. Her critics are going to feel that she didn't want to answer some tough things in full.
Well, for her, there's really no benefit to getting into the weeds on a question or an answer like that, because the minute she starts trying to explain it away, it makes it seem like she has something to hide. So what she tried to do is to boost the image of the Clinton Foundation, talk about all of its work overseas, contrast it to some extent with the Trump Foundation, and basically show that this is a foundation that's done a lot of good, and therefore all of these sinister associations people have with it are just misguided. So I think to some extent, if you really want to focus on the specifics and parse every part of her answer, no, she didn't actually answer the question, but it was probably a wise move not engaging that question literally and trying to talk about the good works that the foundation does, because she then is able to pair that with her own personal history of all that she's done for children and families and education.
That's CBS News analyst, professor at American University, Leonard Steinhorn.
Always my pleasure.
On Friday, millions of Americans apparently suffered what was called an internet outage. Twitter said many users were unable to access their tweets. The White House spokesman Josh Earnest blamed malicious activity, meaning a cyber attack by someone.
At this point, I don't have any information to share about who may be responsible for that malicious activity.
Later, how hackers got Clinton campaign emails. Did Russia's government do that? Up next, Trump and Clinton clashed with barbed jokes in New York on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Raviv. Now, another clash in person between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Probably the last time they'll be together in this campaign, the night after their debate in Las Vegas. They both had to show up, that's traditional, and crack jokes at a dinner supporting Roman Catholic good works in New York City. CBS's Margaret Brennan was there.
It was supposed to be a good-natured ribbing to raise money for charity, but there were boos after the Republican nominee went on the attack.
Hillary accidentally bumped into me, and she very civilly said, "Pardon me. Let me talk to you about that
after I get into office.
The Archbishop of New York got the two presidential candidates to break bread and trade jokes.
People look at the Statue of Liberty and they see a proud symbol. Donald looks at the Statue of Liberty and sees a four. Maybe a five if she loses the torch and tablet and changes her hair.
The long tradition of candidates poking fun at themselves and each other at the New York charity White Tie Dinner is meant to honor politician Al Smith, who in 1928 was the first Catholic U.S. presidential nominee. The goodwill did not last long.
Hillary believes that it's vital to deceive the people by having one public policy.
The well-heeled crowd booed some of Trump's nastier jabs.
Here she is tonight, in public, pretending not to hate Catholics.
Trump feigned offense that the media praised First Lady Michelle Obama's 2008 convention speech, but criticized Melania for plagiarizing it.
My wife, Melania, gives the exact same speech, and people get on her case. And I don't get it.
And Clinton nodded to her habit of avoiding questions from the press.
And look at this dais. We got Charlie Rose and Maria Bartiromo and Chris Matthews and Gail King and Nora O'Donnell and Katie Couric. This counts as a press conference, right?
That from CBS's Margaret Brennan in New York. Now back to Nevada, as he was covering the third and final debate in Las Vegas, CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman considered how Nevada has become a battleground state, not obviously red Republican or blue Democrat.
They have both been victorious here this year.
We love Nevada.
In February, Donald Trump won the Republican caucus, while Hillary Clinton won the Democratic caucus. Now they are battling for the state's six electoral votes.
Hi, is this Orlando?
Both campaigns are working hard.
Hi, my name's Kathy, and I'm working with the Democratic Party here in Las Vegas.
The race here is tight.
Is it close? Is it within the margin of error? Absolutely.
That's CBS News senior political editor Steve Chigueras. Clinton is helped by strong union support and the state's large Hispanic population, but Nevada is also a state that strongly supports gun rights and has a powerful anti-government streak. That should help Trump. Last month, the polls showed Trump in front. Now Clinton has taken the lead. David Damore is political science professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
Her campaign has the voter registration advantage, and they're just much better organized in the state.
Steve Futterman, CBS News, Las Vegas.
Now the two wars that might help the U.S. and its allies in their vow to defeat ISIS, a big offensive to push the so-called Islamic State out of Mosul in northern Iraq, has begun, led by Iraq's army with Kurdish militia backed by U.S. airstrikes and American advisors risking their lives on the ground. Cammy McCormick reports one died Thursday.
A U.S. defense official says the American was killed as he accompanied Iraqi counterterrorism forces northeast of Mosul. Their vehicle, which was an armored vehicle, hit an IED and may have rolled over. The American was medevaced to Erbil but died of his injuries. He is the first combat death among the Americans associated with the battle for Mosul. Defense Secretary Carter said this is evidence that Americans are in harm's way.
CBS's Cammy McCormick traveling in the Middle East with Secretary Ash Carter. ISIS, to distract from the Mosul campaign, killed more than 30 people in Kirkuk, a usually peaceful city in the Kurdish part of Iraq. CBS News correspondent Holly Williams, not far from there, reported Friday.
There were multiple explosions in Kirkuk this morning, suspected suicide bombs, and gunmen attacked at least one government compound. There are also reports that ISIS fighters may have holed up in a hotel and a mosque, shooting it out with the Kurdish forces that control the city. Meanwhile, Iraq's elite special forces have recaptured the Christian town of Bartella, which is about 10 miles east of Mosul. And the Iraqi military told us that ISIS used at least 8 suicide car bombs. Those are cars and trucks laden with explosives and driven at high speed towards Iraqi forces.
Here in northern Iraq, people are bracing for more.
CBS Evening News anchor Scott Pelley questioned Holly Williams and also our foreign correspondent Elizabeth Palmer, who just came out of Syria, checking if statements made by Trump and Clinton in their debate made sense.
Whatever happened to the element of surprise? We announced we're going after Mosul. I've been reading about going after Mosul now for about, how long is it, Hillary, 3 months? These people have all left.
So, Holly, is Trump right?
Well, Scott, I think that secrecy would have been very, very difficult. This is a multinational effort, not just the U.S., and most of the thousands of fighters on the front lines here are from Iraq, from different factions, ethnic and religious groups. Remember also that making it public that the offensive was about to begin gave the residents of Mosul, who are being used as human shields, a chance to try to escape. Or perhaps to prepare to rise up against ISIS.
Holly, Trump also said advance warning gave the leaders of ISIS a chance to escape Mosul. What of that?
Now, it's true that the U.S. military told us that some ISIS leaders may have fled the city. But on the other hand, the extremists are still putting out their slickly produced propaganda videos from Mosul.
Now let's go over to Syria, where the dictatorship and its Russian ally are bombing rebels and civilians. Clinton wants a U.S.-enforced no-fly zone.
I think a no-fly zone could save lives and could hasten the end of the conflict. This would not be done on the first day. This would take a lot of negotiation. It would also take making it clear to the Russians and the Syrians that our purpose here was to provide safe zones on the ground.
So, Liz, what would the U.S. have to do to enforce a no-fly zone?
Well, the first thing it would probably do is look for strategic partners. It wouldn't want to go it alone in a very controversial operation, and it may also look for backing from the U.N. That could take months. Secondly, the risk of escalation is huge. Not only would the U.S. have to face the possibility of shooting down a Russian warplane, but it would have to destroy Russia's new ground-to-air missile system, which is now installing in Syria.
Elizabeth Palmer reporting from our London bureau. Stay tuned, a lot more, including how did all those Clinton-related emails get hacked, here on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Networks Advanced Firewall Solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS to learn more.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Raviv. When it comes to secrets from inside the Hillary Clinton campaign, most of the emails that have been leaked and not absolutely confirmed as authentic and unchanged were the result of hacking into the Gmail account of the Clinton campaign chairman. And CBS's Nancy Cordes reported Thursday that Clinton's Republican opponent has condemned the leaks only in mild and general terms. He enjoys using them.
Boy, that WikiLeaks has done a job on her, hasn't it?
For 2 weeks now, John Podesta's emails have provided Trump with a steady stream of new material, revealing how a passel of aides massaged Clinton's positions on trade, Wall Street regulations, and the Keystone Pipeline.
I mean, what they said about Catholics and evangelicals and so many other things.
Today, the cybersecurity firm SecureWorks said it has determined that Podesta unwittingly entered his credentials on a fake Google login page set up by Fancy Bear, a notorious group of Russian-linked hackers. The Clinton campaign said there is no longer any doubt that Russian President Vladimir Putin is trying to help Donald Trump by weaponizing WikiLeaks.
Nancy Cordes reporting on Thursday in what the Obama administration calls a publicity stunt, Russian diplomats in the U.S. asked at least three states if Russian observers could be at polling stations to watch how the voting takes place on November 8th. The Russian request was rejected by state officials. Let's get another report on a battleground state where early voting has just begun, North Carolina. In 2008, Barack Obama won that state. In 2012, Mitt Romney flipped it back to Republican. CBS News correspondent Weijia Jiang takes a look.
North Carolina has deep Southern roots, from its culture to its painful past.
Racism is still here, you know. It's still here. I can feel it breathing down my neck.
Black voters here tell us race relations have worsened in recent years. The police shooting of a black man in Charlotte last month led to days of protests. Christopher Hines thinks Hillary Clinton is the only presidential candidate who can help bring reforms.
I think Clinton would be much better at making that change happen because she's for human beings.
23% of voters in North Carolina are black. 96% of them voted for President Obama 4 years ago, and he still lost the state by 2 points.
My question is, what does America have to gain by electing Trump?
Nancy Laxton says some people are too sensitive to what she calls Trump's honesty.
Everything he says, they try to make it that he is trying to be prejudiced, and that's not what he's saying.
Bishop James Woodson disagrees.
He has taken on with a sense of comfort to be able to say what I think some folk have been wanting to say for the last 8 years.
And how does it make you feel when you hear these things?
That it's not dead.
What's not dead?
Racism.
Black voters tell us that issue will be key when they go to the polls. And in such a tight race, their vote could determine who wins. Weijia Jiang, CBS News, Greensboro, North Carolina.
A man in Maryland who's in his 50s and worked as a contractor inside the National Security Agency now faces more charges under the Espionage Act. The alleged motive of Harold, known as Hal Martin, still not clear. He was arrested in August. The arrest was kept secret until 2 weeks ago. CBS's Chip Reed reported what was known Friday morning.
Court documents reveal that Martin allegedly stole more than 50 terabytes of information from U.S. government agencies, including the NSA. That's the equivalent of about 500 million pages and could be the largest theft of U.S. government data in history. Prosecutors are worried he's a flight risk and say he has communicated online with people in languages other than English, including in Russian. His lawyers insist he did not intend to betray his country.
That from Chip Reed in Washington. Exploding airbags in cars now blamed for another death here in the United States. CBS's Frank Settapani reports.
Federal officials say a Southern California woman has become the 11th person in this country to die in a traffic accident involving a defective Takata airbag inflator. Jose Contreras says his mother was on her way to get a flu shot when she was killed in a head-on crash.
My mom was a very safe driver. Seatbelt was on always and stuff like that. She didn't text and drive.
Honda says the woman's 2001 Civic had been recalled to have the airbag replaced, but there's no indication it was ever repaired. Her son says he doesn't remember getting a recall notice. Frank Settapani, CBS News.
The latest on Obamacare, the health reform law, the White House prediction is that 13.8 million people will sign up for coverage under the Affordable Care Act for next year, up by more than 1 million from this year. Officials call that good, but not good enough. CBS News White House correspondent Pam Coulter.
President Obama chose Miami-Dade College as the site to urge more young people to sign up for health coverage when open enrollment begins next month. Not enough young and healthy people have signed up to offset the costs of older, sicker people. And former President Bill Clinton said while millions more have coverage, many still struggle to pay big premiums.
It's the craziest thing in the world. The people that are getting killed in this deal are small business people and individuals who make just a little too much to get any of these subsidies.
On Thursday at that college in Miami, President Obama.
Why is there still such a fuss? Part of the problem is the fact that a Democratic president named Barack Obama passed the law.
He said it's not perfect, no law is, but it's a big step forward, like buying a starter home.
It's a lot better than not having a home, but you hope that over time you make some improvements. Never in American history has the uninsured rate been lower than it is today.
Troubling developments in Asia. China's defense ministry says the U.S. Navy, by patrolling the South China Sea, is doing something illegal and provocative. And America's traditional ally, the Philippines, just turned against the United States. While visiting Beijing, President Rodrigo Duterte, who clashed with President Obama over human rights this year and therefore they did not meet, declared his separation from the U.S. in military and economics because he has no boss except the people of the Philippines.
Defense Secretary Ash Carter seems unwilling to accept that. The U.S. works very closely with the Philippines Armed Forces.
Obviously, any relationship is one of mutuality, and we'll continue to discuss that with our Philippine counterparts.
The State Department spokesman John Kirby, a retired admiral, said the U.S. would seek clarifications, but for now, kind of a warning to China not to seize more islands or waterways.
We remain rock solid in our commitment and the mutual defense treaty that we have with the Philippines. That hasn't changed.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest, after hearing Friday that President Duterte was walking back his fiery comments a little.
That seems to be a change in tone that is more consistent with the 7-decade-long alliance between the United States and the Philippines.
We'll have more on that story in the days ahead. Don't forget our app for your smartphone. The free app is CBS Radio News. Also, you can follow us on Twitter for headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Revive on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. Here's how President Obama dismissed Donald Trump's statements lately that there's a lot of fraud in the U.S. electoral system. Mr. Obama was in Miami at a Hillary Clinton campaign event, though without Hillary Clinton.
When you suggest rigging or fraud without a shred of evidence, Trump becomes the first major party nominee in American history to suggest that he will not concede despite losing the vote, and then says that he will accept the results if he wins. That is not a joking matter. That is dangerous. Because when you try to sow the seeds of doubt in people's minds about the legitimacy of our elections, that undermines our democracy. Then you're doing the work of our adversaries for them, because our democracy depends on people knowing that their vote matters. So I'm telling you, Florida, your vote does matter. Your vote does count. And this whole notion of voter fraud, listen, one study shows that out of 1 billion votes cast, there were 31 proven cases of voter fraud. 31 out of a billion.
However, Trump says there are serious flaws in the electoral system, including 1.8 million dead people who are still registered.
And some of them vote. One was a Republican and after death became a Democrat. It's true.
Trump also mentioned millions of people who could game the system by voting in more than one state, apparently meaning citizens who forget to deregister when they move to another district or another state, so indeed they are registered in more than one place. As we've reported, Democrats say there's hardly any fraud, it has no impact on results, and they accuse Trump of denigrating the system, which harms people's faith in our democracy. President Obama had this to say this past Tuesday at a joint news conference at the White House with Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. When asked about Trump saying the election is rigged,
he started whining before the game's even over. That is both irresponsible and, by the way, doesn't really show the kind of leadership and toughness that you'd want out of a president.
A Republican senator who often criticizes Trump, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, said if Trump loses, it won't be because the system failed. It's Trump's failure as a candidate. And Senator John McCain of Arizona said losing in 2008 was no fun, but it was his duty to concede the election because that means accepting the will of the American people. The candidate's daughter, Ivanka Trump, who's 34, was campaigning for her father in Wisconsin on Thursday. She didn't mention that he might possibly refuse to accept the election results, but she did say,
"He's not politically correct." And I think we love that about him, right? 97% of the time.
What you see is what you get. What you hear is what you get. He is incredibly candid. He will never lie to the American people, even if that's not what somebody wants to hear. It's who he is.
Now to a specific subject that came up in the debate on Wednesday in Las Vegas, the Affordable Care Act, the health reform law frequently called Obamacare. Let's hear from an expert on the ACA, Brian Blaze, a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center in Virginia. At all three debates, Brian, did Trump and Clinton say enough about their plans for health coverage?
Dan, I think my biggest disappointment with the campaign is so little attention the candidates have focused on health care. I mean, Medicare and Medicaid are key drivers of health care spending and government deficits, and the Affordable Care Act is the largest government program passed over the last several decades. It's a major expansion of federal spending and regulation, and it came up very little.
In the third debate, Donald Trump did repeat something that he has said on the campaign trail. It's a disaster, and Obamacare needs to be repealed and replaced. Now, that's not a full picture of what he would favor doing.
Yeah, so I think it's much easier for Republican candidates to talk about the broken promises in the law, the fact that premiums are going up significantly, and that many insurers are leaving marketplaces. It's much harder to come up with what the replacement plan is going to be. And so far, we've heard from Donald Trump that he's going to replace it with something terrific, without many details.
Okay, and how would you describe, to be fair, what Hillary Clinton said, which seems to me there could be some flaws, but we have to work with it because it is covering millions of Americans who didn't have coverage before.
Yeah, I think Secretary Clinton's position is going to be to try to increase the number of people signing up for coverage by increasing government subsidies directed at people in the middle class who, for the most part, are sitting on the sidelines now because the coverage isn't worth the price to them. She's also exploring price controls for prescription drugs and other types of tax credits to make the coverage more attractive.
Would you agree that whoever is the president, they'll have to do something, though from the current White House, we usually hear from Obama administration officials, the Republicans who control Congress don't want to cooperate. They don't want to have any hearings, so there's no serious effort to improve the ACA. Where do things stand? Would you expect, no matter who is the president, there must be serious work on this?
I think there could be bipartisan pressure. I mean, you've heard former President Bill Clinton call Obamacare the craziest system in the world. Minnesota's Democratic governor has said that the law is unaffordable in his state. So I think the basic economics of the law, the rising premium increases, the fact that many people aren't going to realize what the premium increases are until open enrollment starts, which is a week before the election, I think that could create pressure on politicians to address many of these problems next year.
Like others at the Mercatus Center, you usually take a libertarian point of view. Do you think it's an open and shut case that this government reform of health coverage is a failure?
So the ACA has reduced the number of people that don't have health insurance, but it's done so at a much larger cost than was expected. And it's also produced lots of adverse effects in the insurance market. The individuals have less choice and there's less competition. So I think it is an open and shut case that the law needs significant change. I think it's debatable whether political actors can reach a settlement next year.
Brian Blaze at the Mercatus Center, I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now our weekend roundup commentator, Charles Grodin, who's got an idea that friends, partners, spouses should be perhaps graded on a curve. Don't be quick to say they've failed.
Reading in Time magazine about someone winning the Nobel Prize in chemistry took me back to my high school days when, among other things, we had to take chemistry and algebra. Both, I thought then and now, should have been optional. I remember the teacher, Mr. Darnell, putting our report card face down on our desk like we were in a game of casino. I slowly turned mine over, certain I had failed. I was shocked to see I'd gotten an A. That's when I learned about grading on the curve. That's meant, compared to the other kids, they probably wished it was all a dream. You know what I mean. See if they can find someone to teach how to get along in a relationship. I'm Charles Grodin for the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Please stay tuned to the Weekend Roundup. We have a lot more coming up.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS Radio News app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up. It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, the CBS Evening News, and the Weekend Roundup when you want it. You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS Radio News app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. A French victim of terrorism in Paris last year refuses now to give the ISIS killers any respect by hating them. Correspondent Vicky Barker in London has that story.
In the immediate aftermath of the massacre in Paris 11 months ago, one Facebook post was shared 200,000 times. It was written by Antoine Laris, whose wife, Hélène, was killed in the Bataclan nightclub, leaving a heartbroken husband and a 17-month-old son, Melville. Antoine's post was an open letter to the killers saying, "I will not give you the gift of my hatred. I will raise my son, and every day of his life, this little boy will insult you with his happiness and freedom, because you won't have his hatred either."
Hélène is still with me. The grief is still with me.
Antoine has now written a book about the 12 days that followed that awful night. It's called You Will Not Have My Hate, and he admits that's not always easy.
It's a daily struggle, like not hating them.
But he says he refuses to give in, refuses too to allow the events of that night to affect how he sees the Muslims around him.
If we want to live as a society, we need to respect each other and to live each other and find a way to go on together. So, we have to.
There's something he won't share, how he will one day explain to Melville just how his mother died. That, he says, is between them. The Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel once wrote, "The opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference." Antoine's indifference is a far more potent weapon against ISIS than his hatred ever could be. I'm Vicky Barker, CBS News.
Now to one of our colleagues, correspondent Barry Peterson, telling about a way that some women fighting breast cancer and getting chemotherapy are able to keep their hair, thanks to a frozen cap on their head during treatment. Please note, the first patient you'll hear is Barry's wife.
There's nothing unusual about the chemotherapy drugs Mary Nell Wolf is getting at this Denver clinic.
You want to do your chin strap?
What's unusual is on her head, a cold cap, chilled with dry ice to 30 below. As it warms, a new one is strapped on tightly every 20 to 30 minutes. This goes on for 8 hours.
It's not really pain. It is an overall feeling of, I just want this off my head.
In the most recent study, roughly 66% of women kept more than half of their hair. Doctors have different ideas about why it works. One theory is that it constricts blood flow, keeping the chemo from reaching the scalp. Another is that it freezes many of the hair follicles and the chemo is simply shut out.
Is it working?
It is working. I have the majority of my hair. Mm-hmm. The oncologist told me this morning that I would have been completely bald had I not used the cold cap.
She gets moral support from her husband. That's me. We are together on this journey.
Why is maintaining your hair important to a woman?
I think it gives you a sense of control. It gives you a piece of dignity.
It doesn't work for all chemo drugs or for cancers carried through the blood like leukemia. There are concerns that blocking the chemotherapy could let cancer spread to the scalp.
The women who choose to do the cold cap are really motivated.
Dr. Tessa Siegler is an oncologist at New York's Weill Cornell Breast Cancer Center.
Our opinion is that the risks are very, very small, if any.
Using these caps can cost a patient several $1,000 out of pocket, because they are rented by the month. In New Jersey, Susan Melchione decided it was worth the cost because, for her, there was no price on beating cancer.
I can go out and just be who I am and not have the breast cancer define me.
Again, what some women have tried successfully is a chemo cold cap. Medical insurance does not pay for it. Now the former champion golfer Tiger Woods and his plan to return to the tee and to the green. His foundation is celebrating 20 years of helping people, Tiger says, but the 40-year-old ran into some personal scandals, and then he didn't play very well. He had some injuries. As seen on CBS This Morning, Tiger Woods was questioned by Charlie Rose.
When do you think you'll come back?
I'm hoping to come back in December.
You are? Mm-hmm. You believe you can do that? You'll be ready?
More hard work.
More hard work. It's not just you, it's us. We can't let you go. I mean, there's a sense that we never...
Oh, you care?
Well, yes. No. But there is a sense that we never understood how it was to be so brilliant. on a golf course. We didn't get how one could be so dominant in a sport. We didn't understand how you could lose that either. You've thought about that.
Of course, Charlie. I miss being out there. I miss competing. I miss mixing up with the boys and coming down the stretch.
You like being Tiger Woods?
I like beating those guys. And that's why I practice all those hours. Do I miss it? Absolutely, 100%. And to be at my age now, at 40 years old, I'm the first one to admit I can't do the things I used to be able to do. But most people can't. I have to find different ways to go about it.
You have to find other ways to win?
Yes, I do. But I'm naturally a tactician. Even when I was hitting the ball long and blown over the top of bunkers, that was the strategy. And so I used my mind, and then eventually the method I used allowed me to master my craft.
But that's why the mind is so important. You learned that from your father, I
assume.
Correct. Yep. You learned mental toughness. Mm. You learned how to win. You still have that.
Oh, yeah. That part hasn't left me. I know how to get it done. I just need to get into a position to get it done.
Some have said to be Tiger Woods was both a gift and a burden.
It's a burden in the sense that the amount of obligations that I have at a tournament, anonymity that was lost. You know, if you look back, the only regret I have in life is not spending another year at Stanford. That's the only regret I wish I had.
Of all the things that's happened to you.
All the things, I mean, that's all.
Everything.
All the things I've learned, all the things I've been through are tough, but they've been great for me. But I wish I would have gone one more year at Stanford.
Would you be the golfer you are without your dad?
No.
You would not be the champion that you became.
Without my dad or my mother. There's no way.
Both of them.
There's no way. No.
Because your mother stood by you and stood by him.
My mother was so supportive and so loyal and so great as a mother that there's no way.
She was also supportive after Thanksgiving 2009 mm-hmm. when you had a public humiliation. Mm-hmm. Some would suggest, obviously, that humiliation you went through mm-hmm. publicly, your private life exposed, has a lingering effect on your mind and your game.
I've heard that too.
I know.
I made a bunch of mistakes. In the end, Elin is my ex-wife. She's one of my best friends. We've had two beautiful kids.
How do you tell your kids why Mama and Daddy are not together?
It's because Daddy made some mistakes, and I'd much rather have them hear it from me. I say that everybody makes mistakes, and the reason why Mommy's living in her house and Daddy's living in his house is because Daddy made mistakes, and it's okay.
How Tiger Woods explains to his two children, who are 7 and 9, that he and his ex-wife, Ellen, were divorced 6 years ago after he was caught cheating on her. Well, that took your mind off the political campaign, probably. But here at CBS News, the race for the White House is our main focus. Please use our app for your smartphone to hear the latest. The app is called CBS Radio News. The Weekend Roundup is produced in Washington by Howard Arenstein. I'm Dan Revive, CBS News.